This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, it's a real privilege to have in the studio with me the folk singer and organizer, Cy Khan. He's been putting out albums for more than three decades now. He's written some plays, including one about Mother Jones. He's the author of three books, How People Get Power, Organizing, A Guide for Grassroots Leaders, and most recently, The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy, which he wrote with his partner, Elizabeth Minnick. And finally, he's the executive director of the nonprofit group Grassroots Leadership. That's certainly enough for one man. Cy Khan, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Matt, I'm happy to be here.
Tell me, which came first, your interest in folk music or movement politics?
They come very much together. Where I really understood the power of folk music was in the Southern Civil Rights Movement. I was with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the militant student wing of the Southern Civil Rights Movement. You could not be a part of the Southern Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s and not feel, not sense, not experience the extraordinary power of music. And it is a folk music. It's a music that was recreated daily by the people who were leading the struggle, and I was happy enough to be a witness to that.
What was SNCC like?
It was like being in the heart of the most extraordinary, chaotic, disciplined, angry, passionate, loving, beautiful, ever-changing march. I had the sense then that we, not I, but we, were very much at the center of a sea change in history. You could not be there and not sense that something extraordinary and quite radical was happening in this country's history, in the history of the world. At the same time, like all organizing, on a daily basis, it was frustrating because you're working with people who are right when they say, I am afraid. It is fine to say, we are not afraid, but I am afraid, and you're wrong, and I'm right.
And there was real reason to be afraid because people were being killed down
there. Afraid, of course. And not just killed, because in some ways that's the most dramatic moment that we all fear but also never expect to happen to us. I once did a test. I asked people, how many of you are willing to die for freedom? This was a performance, and virtually everybody raised their hand. I said, how many of you would be willing to have your little finger broken for freedom? And everybody grabbed their little finger and said, ooh. Because we don't actually think that we're going to, in the United States in particular, that very few of us actually believe that we'll be called on to die for freedom. There are some people and some populations in this country for whom this is a reality, and certainly around the world, being called on to die for freedom is much more real than it is for people who are in this country. But we do expect that other losses of jobs, of reputation, of relationships, that those are real, and that's really what we fear, I think, much more.
And those fears are with us today. I mean, people fear speaking out today and things.
Well, people
like
should fear speaking out when people tell you that you're wrong to speak out. Or as the great African-American ball player Satchel Paige once said, don't look back. Something might be gaining on you.
Or, you know, if you're paranoid, you may actually have some reason to be paranoid.
Somebody may be after you.
That's correct. Now, let me just take you through your development then, both as an activist and as a songwriter. You were involved in the labor movement then after the Civil Rights Movement.
I worked with the United Mine Workers of America during the Brookside Strike in Harlan County.
When was that?
That was in the 72 to 74.
Is that the Harlan County USA film?
Harlan County USA.
Incredible movie.
Incredible. Yeah, wonderful filmmaker, Barbara Koppel, to my knowledge, the only documentary about American working people has ever won an Academy Award, and deservedly so. I worked with the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, now part of Unite, during the J.P. Stevens campaign throughout the South and the rest of the 1970s. So really the 70s are my labor years. The 60s are my civil rights years. The 70s are my labor years. And this year, for me, marks 40 years of organizing.
Wow. That's an accomplishment. What is the temperature of the labor movement today, do you think?
Well, it seems to be going up and down with great rapidity. It's like, you know, does this patient have 96 or 104? It's a movement in great flux. And it's often hard to tell when you're in the myriad, when you are in the middle of a period of significant flux, whether the temperature will ultimately settle down at a healthy level or whether it's going to go too high or too low. I think it's a very hard period of time, given in particular the extraordinary assault on the labor movement by corporate forces, by ideologically right-wing political forces, by fundamentalist religious forces. We should never forget, when we look at the problems that labor encounters, that this is the result of an absolutely deliberate and fairly vicious attack on the right of workers to organize and be represented by unions. And this is a part of the very broad corporate agenda for totally reshaping this country's politics and for undoing democracy.
I mean, I can see why the corporations and why the Bush administration want to undo labor union rights. But where in the Bible, where do the right-wing fundamentalist Christians get the idea that labor unions are sinful?
Probably the alliance of labor unions with other progressive causes. When I was in SNCC, in the Southern Civil Rights Movement, our most honored possession in Forest City, Arkansas, named after General Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, doing its best to live up to his name, was a 3/4-ton, 4-on-the-floor yellow Ford pickup truck that had been donated to our SNCC project by a local of the United Auto Workers in Flint, Michigan. And so the solidarity of much, although not all, of the labor movement with historically progressive causes is, I believe, what makes it frightening to fundamentalists.
Because if they took part of the Bible seriously about helping the poor, and that's what unions do, you would think that maybe they'd have a little more sympathy. But it doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, maybe Walmart will adopt the laborer is worthy of their hire, which is to say, we don't think they're worth very much.
I should live long enough to see Walmart pay people a living wage. Sai Khan, you have a song about the discrepancy in wages that is growing by leaps and bounds. It used to be that the person on the shop floor made, or the boss, let's put it that way, made 40 or 50 times the person, average person on the shop floor. And now it's, 200, 400, some enormous factor of what the average man or woman working for that person makes. You've got a song called The Gap, or $8,862 an hour. Do you mind playing that for us?
Not at all, Matt. Like we say down in traditional music, let's play it then.
Here I am spending my life down among the kielbasa, making your lunch meat, hot spicy sausage and dogs. You can count what I make, that's the reason they call it production. So how come it's you that's living so high on the hog? Sometimes I wonder what CEOs do in an hour. When I see your picture, you're talking away on the phone, shaking some hand or jetting away to a meeting. You're sure not down here on the floor with the gristle and bone. You make $8,822 an hour, $70,400 a day. That's more than $10 million a year. I just can't see it from here. What lets you deserve to be making a killing this way? Sometimes I dream I'm sitting up there in your office. You're working here on the floor for the rest of your life. It's real work down here, but I know in my heart you can do it. The way you cut jobs, you gotta be good with a knife. You cut 500 jobs and you say that you're being a leader. Me and my friends on the floor think it's old-fashioned greed. We can do the right thing and hire them all back tomorrow. If we cut back on you, we'll have all the payroll we need. You make $8,822 an hour. $70,400 a day. That's more than $10 million a year. I just can't see it from here. Unless you deserve to be making a killing this way.
That's Cy Khan singing a song, The Gap, or $8,822 an hour. How is that song received in labor crowds? You do a lot of performances for labor groups. I assume when they hear that line about getting the boss down on the shop floor, that gets a good reaction.
You know, you don't even need to do it for a labor crowd, Matt. You know, you do it for any group of people who go to work every day and people hoot and howl. I did it at Merlefest, which is the bluegrass festival in Northwest North Carolina that was set up in memory of Doc Watson's son Merle, who was killed years ago, in a tractor audience for just an audience of folks coming in for the festival. And people just stomped and cheered.
Well, the amazing thing that the song illustrates, not only the discrepancy on the shop floor, but the huge discrepancy in our society right now between the rich and the poor, the gap that is just growing and growing. And you got to, you know, wonder, as I do, you know, what does that person do with that last $1 million when he's making 10, you know?
Well,
nine
you also
million,
wonder,
what does he do with the 10?
What does that person do in that hour that is so valuable that they are worth that much more than a skilled worker? That's also the core question, not just what do they do with the extra money, but what does that person do that makes them intrinsically so much more worthwhile than someone else who is working just as hard?
And
it's a fundamental question for our society.
Well, I mean, what people get paid is a fundamental moral question that philosophers have wrestled with for a long time. And certainly that discrepancy is not justified. And also, sometimes they're paid regardless of their performance.
Well,
you know, the
course.
Stock can go down, they can be doing a lousy job, and they'll still get that extra bonus and that extra
right. And if they are
dollars.
Let go, they are let go with millions in pensions.
Yes, these so-called.
No, it's a corrupt system, and it's one of the things that we really have got to deal with in this society. I think, Matt, it's one of the places where there's a healthy work ethic that most people in this country believe that you should get a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. And most people in this society work really hard. They work really hard, you know, as cashiers, as nurses, as teachers, as plumbers, as studio engineers, you name it. And they know the quality of their work. They know the worthwhileness of what they do. They know how it contributes. And they think they're as good as anybody else. And that's a healthy kind of a work ethic. They don't understand why someone else who, in the best of times, is only putting in as much time as they are, and in the worst of times is significantly mismanaging a corporation and driving it into the ground along with their jobs, they do not understand why that person should make 500 times what they do. And they're right.
And yet somehow this sentiment doesn't translate into political power, and somehow it doesn't translate necessarily into union power, because the ranks of organized labor in the private sector is now down to 9%, I think. Why is that?
Because of the corporate counterassault on the labor movement. The corporations have been operating forever in the hopes of what they call a union-free environment. The corporations have never declared an armistice in the class struggle. For them, even when from the labor side there was relative labor peace, the corporations always had a long-range vision of getting rid of labor once and for all. And when you have that kind of a long-range strategy, when you have unlimited resources that you can put into it, and when you can conduct not simply anti-union campaigns during an organizing drive, but media and image campaigns that resonate through television, through film, through radio, that create an artificial picture of corporate life and leaders and that demonize workers and labor and unions, you do shape opinion. Mm-hmm. If labor had the resources that corporations have had in order to organize, we would have 50, 60, 75% unionization in this country today. Every poll that is ever done shows that a great majority, a significant majority of American workers want to be represented by a union. When you have that kind of disparity, 60% of workers want to be represented by a union, 9% of private sector workers are represented by a union, It's not about what workers want.
And it gets back to fear that we talked about earlier, Saikhan, the fear of speaking out in this repressive climate we have. There's fear if you want to form a union, because if you organize, you can be fired. If you sign up for a union and sign the card and go out on strike, maybe they'll retaliate like the Walmarts in the world do so often. And then there's a different, similar kind of fear in a different sector, and that is just speaking out publicly against Bush policies because of the encroachment on our civil liberties. I've been writing about what I call the new McCarthyism now since about September 12th, and I've gotten about 200 incidents on it. I know it's an issue that concerns you. You got a song on this subject. It's called, I believe, The Hunters.
When the fields of November turn yellow and gold, and the mountain lakes shine in the sun, fond memories return with the change of the year. Once again, we're in love with our guns. Yes, the great white American hunters are back with their rifles all red, white, and blue. They've been shooting each other for many long years, but this year they'll be shooting at you. Oh, Senator Joe, tell us, where did you go? Take us back to the days of real men. With their handguns in hand, out stalking the land, they're going witch hunting again. Just like wolves on the prowl, they travel in packs, in their camouflage Brooks Brothers suits. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's probably legal to shoot. I used to go rambling all painted in red so I wouldn't get shot for a deer. But if you go wandering out in the woods, you're safer in pinstripes this year. Oh, Senator Joe, tell us, where did you go? Take us back to the days of real men. With their handguns in hand, out stalking the land, they're going witch hunting again.
That's Saikhan. The song is The Hunters. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Who are they witch hunting these days?
Oh, I think just anybody. I think that there is both the specific agitation of fear aimed at a particular person. But that, from my perspective, is less significant to the right-wing corporate strategy than creating a generalized atmosphere of fear in which everyone feels, wow, I could lose my job, I could lose my house, I could go to prison, I could get in trouble, somebody might be watching me, I better be careful.
And yet there are groups that are more in the target, I think, than others as far as witch hunting goes. I agree with you on general fear. But, you know, if you're not a citizen, if you're an immigrant, if you're an Arab coming to the United States, if you're an Arab American here or a Muslim American here or now on the border with Mexico, if you're trying to get in here, there's real witch hunting going on with people with real guns.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, and I couldn't agree with you more about the constituencies. And part of what this balance of generalized fear and specific targeting does, it does create in people who are already fearful the sense that, boy, that could be me. I could be one of those immigrants. I could be one of those Arab Americans. I could be one of those Mexicans. I'd better be quiet so that they don't come after me the way they're coming after them. It's making an example of one group so that other groups try to separate themselves from the group that is targeted. And this, of course, is very, very bad for democracy. It's bad for solidarity. It's bad for organizing. It is very, very much a deliberate way of dividing and conquering. And it uses race and racism as explicit tools of splitting popular movements and keeping people from mobilizing against what they know is not in their self-interest.
And that's been a classic,
it's classic
tactic
it
for
so
200 years here.
Absolutely.
Now, you talked about the problem of organizing. You are the executive director of Grassroots Leadership. You've written a couple of books on organizing. One of the books is entitled How People Get Power. What is the short recipe to that?
Organize.
And how do you organize?
In accordance with what the place, the time, the people, the constituency require. Organizing is not a set of recipes for turning out social justice or social change. Organizing is a way of thinking about the world and being flexible enough to adapt strategies and tactics to what will work in a particular time and place. There are a lot of organizing models. All of them work. All of them don't work. All of them need adapting to specifics. So when you want to help people learn organizing, as Meg Campbell once said, you don't train lawyers to be lawyers. You train them to think like lawyers. In the same way she said, we don't train organizers to be organizers. We train them to think as organizers, a particular way of looking at the world and creating strategies and tactics in response to it.
You've described yourself as a mechanic of people's movements. What is your best mechanical skill that way?
It's exactly what I just described. It's the ability to look at a situation, tear it down just like you would an engine block, say, here are the pieces. How do we take these pieces apart? And then how do we reassemble them in a way that the whole engine moves more smoothly?
So, Icahn, one of the things you're organizing about these days is the privatization of prisons. Tell me about that work and a song you have on that subject.
Yeah. Well, first, privatization of prisons has to be seen, Matt, within the overall context of how privatization is being used to move a corporate and right-wing agenda. I remain absolutely convinced that a set of corporations, which in the book The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy, Elizabeth Minnick and I argue that this set of privatizing corporations has made a fundamentally different decision from those that have been made by corporations in the past. They've decided they don't need democracy. They do not need a democratic form of government, and they want to substitute a corporate model of governance in which both government is on a CEO model, but it's either controlled by the corporations where that's possible or where that's not possible, where it's eliminated. And this is what we're seeing now. So you have to look at private prisons within the context of privatization as a tool for dismantling government, dismantling the public sector.
They don't need it. They don't want that strong public sector in anything but police and military and corporate welfare because it could possibly curb their profits and power, correct?
Absolutely. And even within police and military, we're seeing increasing privatization. The war in Iraq is a privatized war. It is a war increasingly fought by private military contractors. This was part of the problem in Abu Ghraib. This is part of the problem in the whole conduct of this so-called war, is the role of privatizing corporations. Private prisons are a piece and a part of this. Today in the United States, we have 120,000 people who are in prisons that are owned by for-profit corporations, and they are there in order for these corporations to make as much of profit as they can. Now, you can argue as to whether or not it's moral or immoral to have private garbage pickup. But on the question of whether a human being should be incarcerated for the profit and convenience of a corporation, that crosses any moral line that anybody can draw in the sand.
So, Icahn, I'd also propose that one reason they want privatized prisons is to cut back on public sector unions, because a lot of the people who traditionally worked in the prison industry were public sector unions, which cuts both ways because some of those unionists were in favor of building more and more prisons. Still, it's a way of getting at union power. Your song on—
Well, right, Matt, but if you generalize from that,
yeah.
if you look at the regulatory forces on corporate power, those forces which restrict corporate power, there's only a handful of them. It's organized popular movements and community organizations. It's the labor movement, and it's government itself. So from the point of view of corporations, you have to take all three out. You have to undercut, discredit, destroy unions, community organizations, and government.
And that's been systematic.
Well, it's systematic. And in fact, the easiest way to destroy public sector unions, which are historically among the more progressive unions. Today, they are those that tend to be organizing more. No public sector unions.
So could you just play a little bit of Van Plantation? We've got about 5 minutes left.
I was hiding in the brush by the Ohio River, Sarah by my side, the baby in my arms. When the slave catchers found us with our backs against the water, winter come late and the ice not formed, and they sold me back south to the old Van Plantation, 200 miles from my home and kin. to be buried in a cell at a for-profit prison, to make some men rich from the trouble I'm in, to make some men rich from the trouble I'm in.
Now that's a short piece of a long song, but this is exactly what's happening, Matt, that in this particular case, this is a true story, that 1,200 young men, almost all African-American, have been shipped from the District of Columbia to a prison built by what was formerly the Wackenhut Corrections Corporation, now known as the GEO Group, on the Van Plantation, a former major slave plantation in eastern North Carolina. This is the prototype of what's happening with private prisons.
How ironic is that? Cy Conn, you've been an activist, you've been a folk singer, you've been an organizer now for four decades. And a lot of people, when they start out, think that they're going to get social change, success, change the world, revolution, whatever it is, great reform, overnight. And the long haul is somehow hard for them to envision, and also to be in it for that long seems to be just too much of a burden to carry, so people burn out fast. You have managed not to burn out. How did you manage that, and how do you suggest other people manage that?
Man, I think it's like any other work. You have to see yourself as a worker, and you have to protect yourself with all the protections that you would want for any other worker any place. You have to have paid vacations, you know, vacations with pay, take the kids to the seashore, like Pete Seeger says. That's not always easy. But it's also not easy in factory work. It's also not easy in teaching. It's not easy in writing. It's hard to learn a healthy work style in an unhealthy work-based society. But I also argue with what people see as the limits on what we can accomplish in our lifetime. In my lifetime, we have undone legal segregation. That doesn't mean we've undone racism. The position of African Americans in this society today is radically different from where it was 50 years ago. Not where it needs to be. I'm not underplaying the role of racism and institutional discrimination in this society. The role of women in this society, of gays and lesbians and bisexuals and transgendered people. The roles of working people in terms of safety protections. And internationally, who ever thought that Mandela would be free? I mean, who ever thought that countries all over the world would be demanding varieties of democratic rule?
Right? Yeah, I think that's crucial to recognize. You have a song, I Have Seen Freedom, that I'd like to end the show with. Cy Conn, it's been a real pleasure
it's
talking
wonderful
with you.
To be back with The Progressive and you, Matt. Thank you so much.
I read in the paper, I watched on the show, they said that it happened a long time ago. The years had gone by, I just didn't know, working for freedom now. The songs that we sang still ring in my ears, the hope and the glory, the pain and the fears. I just can't believe it's been 45 years, working for freedom now. Been a long time, but I keep on trying, for I know where I am bound. Been a hard road, but I don't mind dying. I have seen freedom.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.